And we don't know what's going to happen to the Wagner Group. There has been no official statement that the Wagner Group was going to be disbanded. Because the Wagner Group doesn't actually exist as a formal entity in Russia, I think that that's very unclear. What does seem to be increasingly clear is that there is some kind of a action being taken in Russia against high-ranking military officers, uniformed officers who may have been supporting Prigozhin. Serdarvykin is the one that has now seemed to be confirmed by the most Western media sources as having been detained. We don't know that he's actually been imprisoned. He may just being questioned by the FSB for his role in things, but he has not been seen since Saturday. Apparently, his family has not heard anything from him since Saturday. And so it appears that there may be some form of investigation or house cleaning taking part in Russia of uniformed Russian military sources who may have been on Prigozhin's side. That's about all we know at this point.
Well, we want to thank you, Kimberly Martin, for joining us, professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University. Next up, the media is doing a great job covering the smoke unleashed by the wildfires raging in Canada. But what about the fire and where it comes from? We're going to look at climate silence in the media. Stay with us.
Try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you. When tears come down like falling rain,
You're Cheating Hard by Hank Williams here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to the climate crisis and its impacts being felt across the United States from the Midwest to the East Coast as millions face record heat and horrible air quality from smoke unleashed by the Canadian wildfires, hundreds of them. About 20 states that are home to nearly a third of the American population are under air quality alerts, including Chicago.
You kind of smell it now. Now you kind of smell it. So I keep a mask on at all times to protect our elders. And so, but now I think we need a mask on for this, too.
I feel like we should fix this if we can. It seems like we should be doing something about it.
Meanwhile, in Canada, Toronto's air quality is among the worst in the world due to the wildfire smoke. This comes as more than 45 million Americans are living in places that were under heat alerts Wednesday. A heat dome is lingering over Texas, where temperatures have reached some of the hottest on Earth. California is expecting a heat wave this weekend. An increased use of solar power in Texas has reportedly helped to stop the state's energy grid from collapsing. Meanwhile, new report by the group Stand.Earth and the University of Waterloo shows pension funds with major fossil fuel stocks have been tanking compared to those divested in order to reduce their carbon footprint. For more, we're joined by longtime Canadian climate activist Sipora Berman, International Program Director at Stand.Earth and chair of the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty Initiative. Her most recent article for The Guardian titled, Canada is on Fire and Big Oil is the arsonist. You know, Sipora, here in the United States, we are hearing about the terrible effects, and we experience them in New York, of the apocalypse caused by the Canadian wildfires. But we don't hear about how Canadians are dealing with these 500 wildfires. Can you talk about what's happening there and then this larger connection to the climate catastrophe?
Absolutely. Thanks, Amy. What's happening across the country is devastating. What we need to remember is that this is the beginning of wildfire season in Canada. So we have now, as you said, close to 500 fires burning across the country. Officials are saying at least 200 of them are out of control and could burn the entire summer. So there has been over 8 million hectares of forest destroyed already this fire season. That's about 20 million acres. 120,000 people have had to be evacuated and leave their homes. And of course, the smoke is choking people in Toronto and Ottawa and Montreal and now throughout the United States.
Sapporo, could you elaborate? Let's go to the article that you wrote, Canada is on fire and big oil is the arsonist. Could you elaborate? What are the points that you make there?
Well, just 2 weeks ago, new scientific research from the Climate Hub of the Union of Concerned Scientists made a direct and measurable link between the increase in wildfires, not only in Canada, but also in the United States, and the carbon emissions from major fossil fuel producers. In fact, they looked at the Carbon Majors study, and they showed that there are 88 companies that are responsible for the emissions that are trapped in our atmosphere today and literally smothering the earth, causing this dramatic increase in wildfires, the heat domes that you talked about, the floods, extreme weather. And so these 88 companies are directly responsible for what we are experiencing right now. 13 of those companies are in Canada. We hear a lot about the smoke, but people aren't really talking about the fact that 86% of the emissions trapped in our atmosphere today, they come from three products: oil, gas, and coal. And the fossil fuel industry, it has been shown in courts across the world and in the United States that these companies knew. They knew what their products were going to do decades ago. They denied it. They delayed it. They delayed progress of policy. They're spending $500 million a year, the fossil fuel industry, to lobby against and weaken climate policy. And now they've slowed down the transition to cleaner, safer electricity systems, to cleaner, safer transit, ways to heat our homes without poisoning us. You know, in some ways, this is like big tobacco when they knew decades ago, except they're not just poisoning us, they're poisoning our whole families, and they're threatening the air we breathe and a stable climate.
And Sapporo, could you speak in this context about the Trans Mountain Pipeline and the Trudeau administration's response to it?
You know, in a lot of ways, we talk about the big areas of carbon that are still underneath the ground, the oil, the fracked gas, the coal that is still underneath the ground as carbon bombs. And the Trans Mountain is the Trudeau lit a fuse to one of the largest carbon bombs on the planet. What's really fascinating right now is that we're seeing investors pull away from major fossil fuel projects, not just in Canada, but around the world, because they know that renewables are cheaper and they can see that climate policy is going to have to constrain fossil fuel projects if we're going to keep the world safe. And so investors pulled out of Trans Mountain, and the government turned around and funded it with public dollars. Now close to well over $20 billion of taxpayers' money has gone into this pipeline project that crosses 3,000 streams. That would be if it goes forward, and right now it's being built, it's going to facilitate the expansion of the oil sands, which is one of the dirtiest oils on earth. You know, at a time when we know demand for oil is peaking and going down because around the world we're moving to renewable energy and electric cars. But there was a time when we all thought with climate policy that if demand went down, then fossil fuels would just be constrained. But every government wants to be the last barrel sold. So they're keeping these projects alive, like Prime Minister Trudeau did, by subsidizing them or even outright buying them. So, and that's why
Sipporah Berman, I want to ask you two last questions. I mean, clearly here the hope is activism. That's what changes things. You're a longtime Canadian activist. We're actually speaking to you in Cuernavaca, Mexico, not where you fled to. You're going back to Canada today, but where there is an environmental conference. Can you talk about that activism and also the Pathway Alliance's connection to the Canadian fossil fuel industry and their Let's Clean the Air campaign?
It's a particular kind of hubris that the Pathway Alliance right now is pushing ads across the country. Let's Clear the Air campaign.
And explain what the Pathway Alliance is.
So the Pathway Alliance is an association of some of the largest oil and gas companies in Canada. This is their new advertising campaign to try and convince people that they're part of the solution. But the fact is that, you know, we now have studies over the last month that show that the oil company's net zero plans are meaningless. This week, Shell announced it's going to increase production. And the work of Influence Map has shown us that these companies are spending literally billions on advertising to show that they're green and they're investing in renewables and carbon capture. But the fact is that over 90% of their investment is in new oil and gas, expanding the problem. So, you know, The fact is that these are the most powerful companies on Earth, and this lobby has been holding us back from addressing the climate emergency. And that's why it's critical that citizens stand up and call on our governments to stand up to big oil and protect people. It's essential that we organize. Organizing for divestment in the last decade has resulted in $40 trillion being moved out of fossil fuels. And just yesterday, a new report showed that if pension funds across North America had divested 10 years ago, then they would have saved literally $21 billion. It makes sense to do this now. It doesn't make sense to continue to invest in new oil, gas, and coal, but our governments continue to do it because the lobby is just so powerful. And they're going to continue to push for more fossil fuel development because they're still making billions in profits. In fact, last year was the most profitable year ever for the fossil fuel industry. So we need people to stand up to this industry. We need activism to protest in the streets, to demand our governments stand up to this industry. And we also need international cooperation. And that's why people around the world are now calling for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty to complement the Paris Agreement, because the Paris Agreement doesn't constrain the production of fossil fuels. And we know today that we need to ensure absolute emissions and production decline. So we need to protest at home, and we need to call on our governments to cooperate urgently to stop the expansion of fossil fuels.
Sipporah Berman, we want to thank you for being with us with Stand.Earth and chair of the Fossil Fuel Treaty. We're going to link to your piece in The Guardian, Canada is on fire and big oil is the arsonist. As we bring in Genevieve Günther, founding director of End Climate Silence, a volunteer group dedicated to helping the media cover the climate crisis with the urgency it deserves. She tweeted Wednesday a grim milestone, the top four stories after the Russia headliner on the New York Times app are all climate change stories. Of course, only one article, an explainer piece, actually mentions the climate crisis, and none mention fossil fuels. This is a fail, Professor Günther says. Welcome to Democracy Now! So many people would say the weather is being covered constantly, yet you had a group called End Climate Silence. Talk about what's missing.
So I founded End Climate Silence in 2018. After I spent a morning in my car listening to public radio and hearing three segments on stories that were clearly climate stories. One was about the drought in the Pacific Northwest. One was about the floods in Japan that year that had displaced millions and millions of people. And another one was about how self-driving cars would change the way we moved around and changed our transportation systems. And none of those stories even mentioned climate change, even though clearly climate change was playing a role in the creation of those stories and would have a role in the ongoing transportation systems that we would need to create in order to halt global heating. And so I founded End Climate Silence in order to try to teach the news media that even if you're not telling what you think is a science story or an environment story, even if you're reporting on breaking news as this, you know, smoke all across the United States clearly is, you need to connect the dots to what you're, from what you're reporting to the climate crisis, and then through the climate crisis to the use of fossil fuels that is heating up our planet. So, for example, most of the stories on the wildfire smoke would talk about the unprecedented wildfires that are raging across Canada right now. And some of them even discussed the heat and the drought that's been creating this fire weather north of the United States. But none of them actually articulated the words climate change, and they didn't explain that it is the ongoing use of fossil fuels that is putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and creating these conditions for these extreme weather events, these disasters, which are already affecting Americans' health, Americans' safety, Americans' ability to live normal lives. So our job and the job of the news media is to every story make those connections between what's being reported and the reality of the crisis, because if you don't do that, you're actually performing a kind of climate denial where you are pretending that something that is happening is not happening, where you are proceeding as if the climate crisis weren't already here and weren't already hurting us, hurting our children, hurting our ability to live normal lives and be healthy. So we need to stop this practice. We need to end climate silence and always make that link to the climate crisis, even if you're not writing a specific climate story or a science story or an environment story.
So Genevieve, before we conclude, if you could explain, presumably you've spoken to some of these journalists who cover these stories without talking about the climate crisis. What do you understand about why this issue is not highlighted in their reporting?
Well, I think it's I think that two things need to happen. There needs to be more education about climate change in news media. So reporters who are put onto the climate beat obviously are duty-bound to educate themselves about the climate crisis. But other reporters, for example, the Chicago bureau chief who wrote one of these stories in the New York Times that didn't mention the climate crisis, these reporters don't have any particular professional obligation as it stands now to learn about the climate crisis. But as our planet heats up, even if we, you know, even if we phase out fossil fuels as soon as possible, we are going to continue to see some of these extreme weather events until our, you know, climate reaches a certain equilibrium. So all reporters, no matter what their beat, need to be educated in the climate crisis. And so this needs to happen in journalism programs, and it also needs to happen in onboarding of new journalists into television stations, into newspapers, into radio stations. All venues need to have a kind of institutionalized method to educate their reporters about the climate crisis. And then there needs to be a culture shift where editors understand that the climate crisis is no longer a story simply for the science or environment section. It's a story that is on the front page nearly every day, especially in the summers. And it behooves everybody to make those connections so that readers, viewers, listeners, all citizens can be educated and informed so that they can make the decisions they need to make in the ballot box as activists, as consumers, as Americans and human beings on this planet.
And we just have 30 seconds. I know there are meteorologist groups that, for example, are doing Show Your Stripes that show the climate catastrophe when they're showing the weather. And finally, 30 seconds on your article. We need to talk about the carbon footprint of the rich. Dramatically unequal consumption lies at the heart of the climate crisis. Your final comment.
Yes. I mean, my point there is that sometimes we think about emissions in terms of national contributions to the carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere, but I think it's actually more useful to think about this in terms of class. So it's the top 10% of people in income brackets who are contributing the vast majority of emissions. The top 1%, some of these people have carbon footprints that rise over 1,000 tons of carbon a year. And we know that billions of people in Africa and in the global south emit almost no carbon at all, and yet they're the people who are most vulnerable to the effects of climate change. They are on the front lines. It's coming from us all, but obviously the poorest people are suffering first and worst. So what I'm arguing there is that we don't only need to think about national policy and federal policy, but we need to start talking about a new culture where rich people are not allowed to burn down this planet impunity.
We have to leave it there, but we'll continue to cover this issue. Genevieve Gunther, founding director of End Climate Silence, professor at New School. This is Democracy Now! Next up to Montana. We'll speak with a teenager who joined other teens in bringing suit against Montana. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we turn to Montana, where a youth-led climate trial just ended after 5 days of dramatic testimony on who can be held responsible for the climate crisis. The landmark case was led by 16 children and young adults, ranging in age from 5 to 22. They accused the state of Montana of violating their constitutional rights as it pushed pro-fossil fuel policies that devastated the environment and severely impacted their health. The case is the first of its kind to go to trial in the United States and focuses on a provision in the Montana Environmental Policy Act that blocks Montana from considering how its energy economy may contribute to the climate crisis. A ruling's expected in the coming weeks. We're joined now from Missoula, Montana, by Grace Gibson Snyder. She's a 19-year-old plaintiff in the landmark Held versus State of Montana climate trial. She was 16 when it started. And we're joined by Nate Bellinger, lead attorney in the trial, senior attorney at the public interest nonprofit law firm Our Children's Trust. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Nate Bellinger, let's begin with you. Lay out the legal theory of this case.
Sure. So this case argues that the state of Montana is violating the constitutional rights of these 16 youth plaintiffs by affirmatively promoting fossil fuels as the state's primary energy resource. So all of the fossil fuels in Montana that are being extracted, transported, burned, that's all being done with authorization and permits from the government. And those fossil fuels are resulting in significant greenhouse gas emissions that are exacerbating the climate crisis, harming the youth plaintiffs, and ultimately, we argue, violating their constitutional rights.
Grace Gibson Snyder, could you explain what made you get involved in this lawsuit and what you hope comes out of it?
Of course. So my first memory of thinking about climate change, I was about 5 years old, and my best friend is from the Marshall Islands. And we heard that because of climate change, the Marshall Islands would be underwater within 50 years or so. And so we made posters that said "Save the Marshall Islands" and hung them up around our neighborhood. I remember spelling "ocean" O-S-H-I-N. I saw that on a picture of the posters recently. And then from there in high school, I started getting involved with kind of local organizations and organizing against plastic waste. But through that and through the research I was doing, I realized that as much work as I put in on the local level, as much change as we made here, it would always be less efficient than having policy change. And so then I started looking for ways to get involved at a kind of statewide level. And I found out about our Children's Trust through a club that I was in at school called Students Against Violating the Environment. And I reached out to our Children's Trust and started talking with the attorneys about what being a plaintiff would entail. I asked my parents for permission eventually. And then 3.5 years later, here we are.
Nate, and if you could tell us how the Montana state government has responded. I just saw a note saying that, quoting a spokesperson for the Montana state attorney general, saying that the lawsuit is, quote, a publicity stunt staged by an out-of-state organization that has exploited well-intentioned children and forced Montana taxpayers to foot the bill.
Yeah, so the state of Montana has largely responded with statements such as that you just read, which are not legal defenses. And the reason why they're not, why they're responding this way is because they don't have strong legal arguments to defend the case. We presented compelling expert testimony from Montana's top climate scientists about Montana's role in causing and contributing to climate change. And the state doesn't really have a defense to that. They called one expert at trial. They didn't have any climate scientists. And their main defense really is Montana's greenhouse gas emissions are too small in the global scheme of things to matter. But we provided expert testimony at court to show that Montana's greenhouse gas emissions are significant, both nationally and globally, especially when you already have a dangerous situation with dangerous levels of greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere and an ongoing climate crisis. So Montana's emissions are significant. They're exacerbating the climate crisis. And the state really doesn't have any defense to that or to their ongoing use of fossil fuels. So they resort to these kind of, you know, statements such as accusing us of using the youth plaintiffs. But anybody who heard any of the plaintiffs testify at trial know that is totally not true. And these plaintiffs have really deeply compelling and personal reasons for being involved in this case and for needing to protect their rights.
Grace Gibson-Snyder, I want to make sure you have the last word. You had to cancel soccer practice, your school, because of the smoke. Can you talk about the response of the fossil fuel industry in Montana and the ages of your co-plaintiffs? You testified in the trial. We were showing images of you from 5 years old to 22.
Yes. Yeah, so we all have experienced climate change in different capacities. You mentioned soccer, and for me, that was a big one. I grew up playing soccer. I played through high school, and I had, I mean, a handful at least of practices and games canceled or postponed every year because of the wildfire smoke, which gets so dense here towards the end of every summer and in the early fall that it's dangerous to be outside. It's dangerous to exercise for sure. And so that's exacerbated by climate change and drier forests and higher temperatures. I've also seen melting glaciers in Glacier National Park, which, of course, is a landmark of Montana's landscape. And watching those glaciers melt is such a, you know, devastating thing because it's so iconic for the state. It's so essential for the well-being of the people and of the environment here. And it's just beautiful. And I would hate to be a part of a future where that's not present, where that's not a thing that my kids get to grow up with. And so, you know, those are my impacts. And the plaintiffs in the case have, you know, everything from respiratory illnesses that are exacerbated by climate change to a cattle ranch where the cattle are dying because of drought and famine and et cetera. And so it's been, we all have experienced this in different capacities, but, you know, I'm bolstered by the fact that Montana is fundamentally reliant upon, but also super appreciative of the natural environment.
Grace Gibson Snyder, we have to leave it there. 19-year-old plaintiff in the Montana trial. Thanks to Nate Bellinger. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Research shows that walking through a forest for just 15 minutes can lower symptoms of anxiety and depression and boost positive moods. What better way to welcome spring than by spending time among the trees? As a national nonprofit organization, Tree Canada works to improve the lives of Canadians by planting and nurturing trees in communities across the country. They support individuals, local groups, businesses, and municipalities to increase tree cover and help fight climate change. Join Tree Canada in growing better places to live by visiting treecanada.ca.
Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. Burnaby.